by reading it. Verse 1. Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. Now there was a certain man from Zorah of the family of the Danites whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Indeed now, you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Now therefore, please be careful not to drink wine or similar drink, and not to eat any unclean thing. For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb. And he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines." So the woman came and told her husband, saying, "A man of God came to me, and his countenance was like the countenance of the angel of God, very awesome. But I did not ask him where he was from, and he did not tell me his name. And he said to me, 'Behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. Now drink no wine or similar drink, nor eat anything unclean. For the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death.'" Now, as we said in number one, this was a time of great decline. His national background would tell us that the Israelites had been under the Philistines for 40 years, the longest term of captivity which they had endured during the time of the judges. He was the 12th judge. Now that means 11 previous judges had delivered Israel out of their captivity, but this was the longest time they had been in captivity. Now the parallel we want to draw here, which I think is very important for you and I in handling this subject of separation. So often we say, and I know I've said it of my grandchildren, of younger people, I say, you know, these are really tough days. And to raise young people for the Lord in these days is really tough. But we must remember that decline, darkness, departure are not a problem to God. They're an opportunity. And that's something that I've been trying to lay hold of in my life. But these are not problems to God. These are opportunities for God. The worst times are the more God is able to make you and I shine. As it often goes, the greater the darkness, the greater the light. Now notice too, there is no neutral place for the people of God. They must either be above the world, testifying against it for God, or they must be servants to it. Now this was the position of Israel. They did not take the place that God asked them to take in separating from the other nations. First of all, they should have defeated all the nations and driven them out of the land, but they didn't. And then, instead of living separated from these people, they began to take themselves wives from these people. They began to intermingle with them. And as a result, they became subservient to them. They actually became their slaves. And that's why they needed a judge to deliver them. And the point that Mr. Stoney wants us to see here, because these notes are taken from The Discipline in the School of God by J.B. Stoney, the point he wants us to see here is that we can't be neutral. Either we are above the world or we're servants of the world. We're one or the other. In other words, think of this. To me, it's a tremendous, challenging thought. Either tonight, I am living above the world, living for God, and not allowing the world to influence me, or I am in subjection. I'm a servant of the world. I'm one or the other. I'm not neutral. Now, this leads to a very important point. I'm just going to take a little break here before I go into Roman numeral 2, and I want to expand on something here in regard to separation that is very important. The nation of Israel serves as an example to us of a nation that failed God basically because they would not separate themselves as he asked them to. If you really trace, you know, if you look through Numbers and Deuteronomy, God predicted that the very thing that happened to Israel would happen because they would not separate themselves from the peoples that were around them. Now, we would like to think that the church in our age will be very different, wouldn't we? We'd like to think, well, you know, the church, coming from a better background than Israel, based on greater promises and greater things, would not succumb to the same thing that Israel did. But we are. We're making the same mistakes all over again that Israel made. The church, from a practical standpoint of its testimony down here on earth, is a failure. Now, it's not a failure as far as God is concerned. Because God's going to present the church to his son blameless. But from a practical standpoint, you look at the history of the church, and it's a history of failure. Why? Let's just turn to a verse. It's not in your notes. We'll come back to your notes in just a minute. But why don't you turn to 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy, as you know, is Paul's last epistle. And it basically is written about the last times. I want you to notice a very significant verse. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 19. Because this is a key verse in regard to the subject of separation. Nevertheless, the solid foundation of God stands, having this seal. The Lord knows those who are his, and let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity. That's separation. Departing from iniquity. It's a good definition of separation. Now, what is Paul basically telling Timothy here? He's basically saying, Timothy, there's a day coming when the church will be like a great house. And it will have in it vessels to honor and vessels to dishonor. What are you saying, Paul? What do you mean? Well, he's basically saying the church is going to become permeated with professing with those who say they are Christians but really aren't. And the church is going to be full of them. Now, the Lord knows those are his, you know, Paul says. The foundation of God stands sure. The Lord knows those who are his. And even if the church is permeated with those who say they're Christians and really are, God knows who they are. And God knows who the real church is. But Paul says, but look, if you really are a Christian, depart from iniquity. You know, that's the sign that you can give to the world. Separation is the indication that even though you are part of a church that has become permeated with those who profess to be Christians but aren't, you can be a mark of those that are real. Now, if you were to go over to the book of Revelation, you would find, in looking at the seven churches there, that Satan has had a tactic with the church, just as he had with Israel. And this is why separation, I'm taking a few minutes to point this out, because it's what makes separation so important. His tactic is simply this. He tried persecuting the church, and we have the church of Smyrna, the second church after the infant church of Ephesus. He persecuted the church of Smyrna, and during those days of persecution, when it seems there were about 10 emperors, it talks about 10 days of trial, and it seems as if there were 10 emperors who just poured out persecution on the church. But it just seemed the more persecution, the more the church grew and grew and grew. So then Satan changed his tactics, just like he did with Israel, by the way. He's really old-fashioned. He uses the same methods all the time. And after he warred against Israel, then he sent Balaam along, and He sent the other nations to allure them, to entice them. And so we go from the church of Smyrna to the church of Pergamos. And we find that one emperor accomplished what 10 emperors weren't able to accomplish. He made the church popular, and he got the church to compromise. And what happened was that many unbelievers started to become Christians. They called themselves Christians because it was popular to be a Christian. You could get a better office. You could get better recognition in the Roman Empire under Constantine. And so everybody began to say they were Christians. And as a result, the church was compromised. It was defiled. Until we have that fourth church that became known as the Church of Thyatira, which is really a picture of Roman Catholicism, a church that is bought out by the world, that sold itself to the world, and it is totally compromised. But then we thank God, Sardis came along. And this was the Protestant church that saw the dangers of what happened to the church during Pergamos and Thyatira, how it compromised its testimony, and it broke away. But what's happened to the Protestant churches, the mainline churches? The Methodists, the Episcopalians, the Reformed, or UCC as it's called today, the Lutheran Church. In most cases, they become permeated with unbelievers. And as a result, their doctrine has changed. They become more socially oriented. The gospel is no longer preached. The truths of God word have been drowned out. Now, the important thing is, it's not in these cases, it was not the false doctrine that came first. It was the professing body of unbelievers that came first, and they changed the doctrine that was being taught in the church. Now, I can remember my dad used to tell me he's going to be with the Lord, but he was saved in one of the mainline churches. One of the mainline Protestant churches where the gospel was preached. He was saved in that church. But 50 years later, the gospel wasn't even preached in that church. And I said to him, Dad, what happened? What happened to that church? Well, he said, I'll tell you, he said, they started programs to try to get more people in. And they wanted to build up their church. And so they made their church very attractive. And so that the next thing you know, unbelievers could begin to feel comfortable in the church. In other words, they didn't really have to be saved. They didn't really have to change their life. They didn't have to be separated. Nothing really had to happen. And they felt comfortable. And soon, they took over the church. They got bigger and bigger in number, and the real believers got less and less in number. And soon they took over the church. That's what happens in the mainline Protestant churches. What's happening to the evangelical churches and many assemblies today? Exactly the same thing. Here, Paul says we shouldn't be ignorant of his devices, but we are so ignorant of them. He uses the same old-fashioned methods over and over again, but he really succeeds with them. Because we are such fools. And what do? We try to make our buildings, our places of worship, or whatever we want to call it, we try to make them very attractive and gather in as many unbelievers as we can. And instead of stressing the truth and preaching the gospel, we give them attractive programs. And we make them feel at home. And pretty soon they feel so much at home that they start to really enjoy themselves with it. They no longer get convicted about sin. They no longer feel uncomfortable because the gospel is being preached and they're told that they're going to hell. And they no longer see a difference between themselves and the other people there, and they begin to just feel a part of it, and soon they get on the board, and soon they become part of the committees, and soon they saturate the whole thing, and it's a compromised church. And then the truth begins to change. Then the false doctrine starts. It's a pattern. It's the oldest pattern. And yet we're falling victim to it. We see it happening all around us. Now that was the plight of Israel. Over again. They were compromised. They would get in trouble with the enemy. God had to send them a deliverer. Now notice, Samson was the man that God raised up to deliver him here from the Philistines. Samson was a Nazarite from the womb. He had a very godly beginning. In order to be a deliverer of the people of God from their unholy association, he had to be entirely separated to God. That is, I can't be used of God to deliver people from unholy alliances in their life and compromises in their life if I'm compromising my own life. That's a very simple principle, isn't it? In other words, I can't lift people any higher than I am myself. Right? In other words, we say that God can't use us to lift people any higher than we are ourselves. Now, this is an important basic principle. In other words, how do I prevent the church from compromising, from welcoming unbelievers and having unbelievers become a part of that church and eventually taking it over? How do I prevent such a thing from happening? Well, there's only one remedy to it. If all the believers, or the majority of the believers in that assembly, live separated lives, it won't happen. In other words, the reason it's happening is because you and I are not living separated lives. You know, it becomes an individual thing. It's not something we can legislate. It's not something we can, you know, suddenly say, okay, we're not going to allow this to happen anymore. It'll continue to happen as long as you and I are living compromised lives and not being separated ourselves. So again, we're part of the problem, not part of the solution. Right now, if we want to become the solution, then we need to be concerned about living separated lives. Now, notice, secondly, the parents were asked to set the example for the future deliverer of God's people. And that's something I want to throw out to those of you that are going to be parents someday, or maybe already are. You notice in our story here that the responsibility was first given, of his being a Nazarite, was first given to Hannah and her husband. In other words, she was told, verse 4, please be careful not to drink wine or similar drink and not to eat anything unclean. The mother was to be a Nazarite if her son was to be a Nazarite. She had to live a holy life if her son was expected to live a holy life. And truly, as parents, we can't expect our children to rise above what we are. Thankfully, sometimes it happens. That's been an amazing thing to me, you know. Sometimes there are children who've come out of families where there has been a lot of compromising, and yet God took them, separated them, and they've led dedicated Christian lives. But we can't really expect this. I mean, God in His grace sometimes accomplishes this, but we can't expect it. We can't expect our children to rise above the standards that we set for them. And we're going to be saying more about that in tomorrow's session, last session. Now, Samson, as we know, as the story goes on here, was declared a Nazarite from his mother's womb until his death. But yet, sad to say, he lived anything like a Nazarite. And I sometimes have felt in reading over this story that perhaps part of the problem was that he was born a Nazarite. He didn't voluntarily give himself over to be a Nazarite. And you know, that's a problem that you and I have to deal with. Because I know a lot of you are in the same boat I'm in. You were born and raised in a Christian family. And you take these things for granted. You know, you just figure, well, I've always been a Christian. Of course I'm a Christian. Of course I live the way a Christian should live. Why shouldn't I? I was raised in a Christian family and so on and so forth. The story goes. But A Nazarite, to be a true, sincere Nazarite, requires a voluntary commitment in my life. In fact, I think it requires a crisis. I think that the Christian life is made up of a series of crises. I think the first crisis begins with being born again, being saved. Or perhaps the pre-conversion days when God begins to really nail you to the wall about your sin. And you really start to become convicted. But that's the first. But I think that every Christian also has to go through another crisis that follows. And I'm not at all suggesting, as some would teach, that we go through a second experience in which the old nature is burned out of us and we receive a new holy life. And so I'm not suggesting that at all. We stressed that in the first session, that we always have this warfare between the old and new nature. But it has struck me over and over and over again in reading the biographies of men that God has used through the years. And I know you've read many of them too. I'm thinking of people like Fanny Crosby and Francis Havergal and Hudson Taylor and Dwight L. Moody and Dan Crawford and David Livingston and men whom God has picked up and used in a tremendous way. And you'll find that every one of those men somewhere in their life, usually their early life, because if God doesn't get hold of us in our early life, there isn't enough time left to really develop and use us in an effective way. So it usually happens early in their life. They faced a crisis of holiness. That is, they faced a crisis where they said, look, there's something wrong with my life. Yes, I'm a Christian, but this hasn't really taken hold of me. I'm playing around. I'm fooling around. I'm throwing my life away. I'm just toying with Christianity. It's not real to me. It hasn't really gripped me. I haven't turned my life over to God. I haven't given him my life in consecration to use it the way he wants to. And almost every one of these men faced that crisis in their life where they reached the end of themselves, where they became broken vessels. And in their bedrooms or wherever it might be, they got down on their knees and poured out their heart in grief and tears to God and asked him to renew their life and make it real and make it a life of consecration, of separation and devotion to himself. And I suggest it's going to happen in your life just as it had to happen in the life of those servants of God. Now, Samson never seemed... Notice number one, although he was a Nazarite, he never seemed to be aware of the great moral contrast which should exist between a Nazarite and a Philistine. I mean, notice we're saying here a moral contrast. I'm sure that Samson could have recited for you the difference between a Philistine and an Israelite. I'm sure his mother taught him that when he was a boy on her knees. I am sure that she took Samson on her knee and taught him about the servants of God. I'm sure he knew the stories of Moses and Abraham and Jacob and Joseph. And I'm sure he knew that an Israelite was a covenant, a person of a covenant who was circumcised and set apart from all the other Gentile nations of the world. And he could have told you all those things. But yet, Samson didn't really, when it came down to practical everyday living, he didn't see any difference between an Israelite and a Philistine. That is, he could be perfectly at home in the presence of a Philistine just as much as he could be in the presence of an Israelite. Now, that leads to an interesting question. Do you feel perfectly at home in the presence of the unsaved? I mean, do you find that you can just go ahead and do exactly what they do and practice things just the way they do and it really, really doesn't bother you? Well, that's an alarming signal in your life. And it's one that you really need to do some searching on. I mean, Samson just seemed to enjoy these Philistines. And yet, they were his enemies. I mean, God had raised him up to fight these people. He was to take his sword and he was to go out there and meet these people in the battlefield. And yet, when the battles weren't going on, he was rubbing noses with them and having a great time with them. It's fantastic, isn't it? We're to be in a Christian warfare. We're dealing with a world that has basically forgotten God, has turned God out of their life and turned their back. And yet, when we're not in church, or when we're not really talking about these particular things, we just seem to, you know, really enjoy mixing in with the people out there in the world. We have a great time with them. I've heard people say that I have better relationships and enjoy my neighbors better than I do the Christians in my church. Alarming statement, isn't it? That certainly needs some kind of investigation in our own private lives. Well, to Samson, we noticed, had in verses, let's just look at those verses 1 to 3 in chapter 14. They're alarming verses. Samson went down to Timnah, and he saw a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. So he went up and told his father and mother, saying, I have seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore, get her for me as a wife. Then his father and mother said to him, Is there no woman? Is there no woman among the daughters of your brethren? Among the Israelites? That there's no woman among all my people? That you must go and get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistine? And you know what Samson said to his father? The goal of this guy, the guts that he had, he said to his father who was trying to raise him up to be a Nazarite, a man separated to God to lead the people of Israel, he says to his father, get her for me, for she pleases me well. Now, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, wasn't that controlling you? I've seen her. I want her. Lust of the eyes, I've seen her. Lust of the flesh, I want her. Pride of life, get her for me. I'm more important than Israel. I'm more important than delivering Israel from their enemies. My pleasure, my desire is more important than what God wants to do with me. I don't care how sure God wants me to be a deliverer, but I want this woman. That's more important in my life. You know, I want what I want. What God wants out of me, that'll come later. That's secondary. That's all important. Well, we notice as the story goes on, if you look at number 2 in your notes there in the Roman numeral 3, that Samson loses his wife. We can't go through the whole story. Time wouldn't permit us. But he loses his wife by the hand of the very people to whom she belonged. That is, she was a Philistine, and it was the Philistines, if you read the story, we don't have time tonight, but you read it, it was a Philistine that killed his Philistine wife. First they took her away, and then they killed her. The important moral lesson is this. The world itself eventually takes away those things which rob us of our devotion to Christ. That's a solemn statement. Not original with me, but I think it's one of the most solemn statements I've ever read. Let's just look at that verse in parentheses there, because I think it's an important one, particularly in relation to this story. 1 John chapter 2. If you can lay hold of this, this is one of the most practical points tonight for you to get hold of in regard to what you're doing with your life in the area of separation. Notice in verse 16, let's get it for connection in 1 John 2. For all that is in the world, now this is what got Samson, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. It's not of the Father, it's of the world. Don't make any mistake about this. I mean, let's get that clear. All these things that you see that you want, that's not of God. I mean, let's get that clear. I mean, let's at least be honest with God. You don't say, I saw this, God wants me to have it. No, be honest and say, I saw it, I want it. I don't have to give Samson that credit anyway. He didn't say that God wanted him to have that wife. He said, I want that. Now, the world, verse 17 says, is passing away, and so are its lusts. That is, all these things that we want, that we desire, that we go after, they're passing away. But he who does the will of God abides forever. Why does God want me separated? I mean, is he trying to destroy my happiness? Is he trying to take away from me the good things of life? Is he trying to make me miserable? Is he trying to torture me? Is he trying to... No. God wants me to have the very best that he can give me. And he knows that if I go in for the lusts of this world, I'm losing everything. What a solemn thing it is to visit somebody in their old age. This has happened to me so many times. And you're there, standing there by their bedside. And they say, oh, I'm just so miserable. Why are you so miserable? I want to be home. I want to go to my house. I like my house. I want to be in my house. I don't want to be here. But you can't keep your house. I mean, eventually you've got to lose that. Yeah, but I want my house. I want to go back to my house. But the house passes away, folks. It passes away. You can't keep it. You throw your whole life into it and you're going to lose it. And we spend so much of our time throwing our lives into things that we lose them. We're going to give them up. They're taken from us. God wants to give us that which abides forever. I was passing by in our neighborhood. There's a man who used to live in the corner. He passed away in this one house. And they named the street after him at the corner where he lived. They changed the name. And I said to Carol, I said, do you think you'll ever have a street named after you? She said, no, I don't think so. I'll be like the majority. I won't. Now there was more to the conversation, but I won't go into that. But the point is that some people, you know, just give their whole life to the community, to industry, to business, and they're just thrilled if somebody names a building after them, or a street, you know, or you know, that's the greatest. That's immortality, you know. I mean, I've got this. This is going to go on. If, you know, eventually the building gets ripped down. The street has to make way for a superhighway, right? Or a bomb falls on it during a war. Or, you know, who knows what happens? It passes away. It passes away. That's not what God wants for you. I don't want you to throw your life away on things that are going to pass away. But he has the hardest time convincing you and I of what it is in life that really lasts. We can't seem to get this into our brains, can we? You know, we have this this idea of placing so much emphasis on things that just don't count. And yet that's what we throw our life into. Go to 4. Samson renews his unholy association with the Philistines over in chapter 16. His second unholy alliance with the enemy. Look at verse 16, chapter 16, verse 1. Then Samson went to Gaza and saw a harlot there and went into her. And when the Gazites were told Samson has come here, they surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city. Amazes me, the grace of God. If I had been God at this point, I would have said, all right, Samson, I'm tired of fooling around with you. I told you once, you didn't listen. Now, you don't just want this woman to be a wife, you're going into a harlot. All you're thinking now about is your own pleasures. Not even interested in marrying this woman, you just want to fulfill your own desires. I'm through with you, Samson. Wouldn't most of us react that way? I guess one of the greatest marvels that I think about in my own life is why God wasn't through with me a long time ago. You know, why he just didn't say, look, I'm finished with you. I am tired of you going back into the same things. I deliver you one time, you turn around and you go back into the same thing again. I've had it with you. But he never does he? He never does. As long as there is breath within us, God has prolonged me another day. You know why he has? It's because by his grace, he wants to be gracious to me one more time and give me one more opportunity to turn away from my foolish ways and my folly and separate myself unto him. God spends a lifetime wrestling with us in an attempt to captivate us for himself. He wants us for himself. And he's jealous about that. And it really disturbs and upsets God that I'm not holy for him. Let that thought grip you. God tonight is really upset about the fact that he doesn't have your life because he wants it. That's what he saved you for. And he's not going to rest until he gets it. And some of us have to go through the most gruesome experiences until we get to that place where we're broken and turn our lives over to God. And here's Samson. I don't think we're so much different from him. Don't start exalting yourself and thinking that you wouldn't have been a Samson. If you had had his beauty, his strength, his opportunities, you probably would have done the same thing. Well, we go on here, and we notice Mr. Stoney is telling us Samson should have recognized his weakness and should have sought God's help to avoid it. One of the problems with us is that we're not willing to recognize our weaknesses as weaknesses and call upon God for deliverance from them. God is able to deliver us from anything and everything in our life that is keeping us from him. Now, that's an important point. Try to get that one. God is able to deliver us from anything that is keeping us from him. In other words, it's no good to make excuses and say, well, I just can't help this. I've got this particular thing, this particular. God is able to deliver the righteous. He's able to deliver us out of our temptations. He's able to deliver us out of our testings. For God knows how to deliver. And if you check that verse there, we have in parentheses 2 Peter 2:9, that's precisely what it says. God knows how to deliver. And he is able. The only reason we're not delivered is because we don't ask God to deliver us. We don't ask God to deliver us from the situations that are literally eating up our lives. We say, well, you know, we make lame excuses. Secondly, God will show us a way of escape from temptation that easily overtakes us. He'll show us the way of escape. Trying to think if I want to use this personally. I don't like to use personal examples, but maybe I will. I found a number of years ago in my life, this is just one example, and the reason I don't like to use personal examples, it makes it sound as if you don't have any more problems, and I've got loads of them that I'm dealing with. But this is just one stands out. I was having some real problems wrestling with television. Now I'm not suggesting, I don't want to do that tonight. I'm not pointing out different things that I think you should be doing, you shouldn't be doing. I think that's something you've got to answer individually in your own life. But what I found out was I was becoming a prisoner to television. I was allowing it to consume my life. I was watching it too much. And I didn't really want to, I didn't really intend to, but I would turn it on, you know, just for an hour. I just need to relax for an hour. I would turn it on, but then the one hour would go into the second hour, and the second hour would go into the third hour, and sometimes the third hour would go into the fourth hour. And I almost got to a point where I couldn't wait to get home at night, you know, to finish my work and get done and sit down there on the couch and watch the television. Now, is there any way that we can become delivered from a habit like this? You know, are we committed to this? Is there no way that a Christian can break this pattern of life? Well, God began to speak to me about it, and I realized that for me, now I'm not suggesting this had to be true for every Christian, but for me, there was only one way to do it, and that was to get rid of the television. As long as it was there, it was there. And there it was, right smack in front of me. And so the best way was to turn it out. It's been one of the greatest deliverances in my life. I don't miss it for a minute. Now, I just use it as an example. There are, you know, many areas in your life that have got to be dealt with. We've got to work on them. They're robbing us, consuming us, using up our time, draining our energies, and they don't have to be. And they shouldn't be. And God is able to deliver us out of those. Now, last of all, Samson refuses to learn and falls into the hands of a false woman. And down in verse 4, for the third time, it happened that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. Now tomorrow we're going to talk about a little more about this business of loving a woman. We're going to talk a little bit about the yoke of